With the Olympics starting next week, this week's show will deal with China. Guest John Pomfret brings a fairly unique perspective to the subject. He speaks, reads, and writes Mandarin. He spent 2 years at Nanjing University in the early 1980s as part of one of the first groups of American students to study in China. On the occasion of the 20th reunion of his Nanjing college class, he reacquainted himself with his classmates and wrote about them in his book Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. His classmates came from villages and from cities. Some were Red Guards. Some were beaten by Red Guards. Some siblings starved to death during the calamitous Great Leap Forward. By 1978, Pomfret's classmates had crawled back from village outposts and labor camps and succeeded in testing into college. They graduated, and they constituted the first generation in communist China's history to become agents of their own fate. Some went into business, many joined the Communist Party, some were exiled for their political views, others went overseas and found other things, among them religion. It isn't that John Pomfret has such a different model of anything, but that he, by virtue of his time in China, I think has a bit of a different perspective. And he's currently editor of the Washington Post Outlook section, formerly the Post's Los Angeles bureau chief. He was a foreign correspondent for 15 years, covering big wars and small in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Congo, Sri Lanka, Iraq, southwestern Turkey, northeastern Iran. He lived and worked in China off and on for a decade as a student, then as an AP reporter, and finally as the Washington Post chief in Beijing. He was eyewitness to the 89 Tiananmen Square protest and, in fact, was kicked out of the country while an AP reporter for his witnessing of the Tiananmen Square protests. And in 2003, he was awarded the Osborne Elliott Award for the best coverage of Asia by the Asia Society. Welcome, John Pomfret.
Great. That is wonderful to be here.
Okay. I like listeners to get to know a bit about the people behind the ideas and the work we talk about. Very briefly, what drew you to journalism? And then what drew you to China? Why did you choose to study there?
China was the big draw. I was studying actually neurophysiology at Stanford when I took a China-related course my freshman year, and I did pretty well in it, and the professor was a really accessible and wonderful guy, and he got me hooked, basically, and I junked my alleged career in science and embraced the study of China and East Asia, and journalism came after that, very much after that. So my first love was very much China. And then after my junior year, I got the opportunity, like you said, to go to Nanjing. Well, first to go to Beijing and then to Nanjing as a foreign student, one of the first groups of American students in China. We normalized relations in 79, and lots of Americans began to come over after that. And so I really got a very much a front row seat on China's wonderful and remarkable changes.
Okay. And so it was this love of China that was stimulated by a course at Stanford that got you over there. And let me jump now then to some of the things you've written recently about China, which has certainly been in the news a lot lately with the Olympics coming up, with the Tibetan protests and so on over the last few months. And then we'll talk more specifically about the book Chinese Lessons, which, as I say, is this unique book because you actually are talking to people who were your classmates. But a couple of weeks ago, you wrote in the Washington Post, "Ever since I returned to the United States in 2004 from my last posting to China as the Post Beijing bureau chief, I've been struck by the breathless way we talk about that country. But is China really going to be another superpower? I doubt it." Can you expand on that?
Yeah. Basically, in America, there seem to be sort of two big narratives about China. One from the left, and that is the perspective that, oh, America's falling apart and China's going to eat our lunch. And that seems to be one controlling narrative from the left. The other narrative we get from the right is, oh, my God, look at their military. They're buying all this stuff from the Russians. They're going to eat our lunch as well. And neither side seems to understand that, like us, the Chinese have an enormous number of problems, domestic problems. They have a demographic situation that is extremely ugly. Think the one-child policy. I mean, we think of China as this place of limitless labor, but the reality is their labor force is actually shrinking. So the factory of the world in 20 or 30 years could very well no longer be the factory of the world. The other issue is that their environmental problems are enormous. And it's not just that they contribute a large percentage of particulate matter in the air of Los Angeles, but they're also causing enormous social costs in China as well. Thirdly, they have a huge political problem. At a certain point, they're going to have to liberalize politically. Are they going to be able to continue this remarkable economic trajectory with a vastly and quickly changing political system, which they're going to have to change at a certain point? What I was trying to do with the piece is to remind people that China's rise up to this point doesn't mean that rise is going to continue into the future. The graphs don't always go up. And in America, we have a tendency to think about China. We always think, well, those graphs will go up forever. But as we know in our own country, those graphs don't always go up.
Right. And let me just – I'm going to rephrase a little bit what you said, but see if I've got it right. That, in fact, one has given them one of their biggest advantages over the last few years, which was this enormous labor force, is, in fact – I mean, we see – problems with that. We see demographic problems in Europe. We see demographic problems in the U.S. But what you point out is that in China, it's going to be an amazing flip. You say the elderly will balloon from 100 million people older than 60 today to 330 million by 2050, including 100 million 80 or over. But the system that's been changing from communism to capitalism neither one of them is really set up to care for them.
Right. That's an enormous problem. Basically, China will become the first country on the planet that gets old before it gets rich. I mean, in America, we have Social Security, we have Medicare, we have Medicaid. Okay, they're lousy, but at least we have them. In China, less than a third of the people in the cities have any type of pension, and those pensions are really lousy. And then none of the people in the countryside, and that's 700 million plus people, have pensions at all. So the amount, the social cost of keeping those people alive is just going to be an enormous drain on China's resources. And it's problems like these that Americans, America-China watchers, or Americans who look at China and are fearful of China, don't really take into account when they look at this rising dragon in the East.
Well, it strikes me as interesting. If you study China, that should be that the fact we've just been talking about, leaving aside the political and the environmental, should be pretty obvious. Is it that if you're using China for your purposes in a way, if you're using China to fulfill a role in your narrative, that you that's how come you can ignore such what I would think obvious demographic information?
Well, definitely. Yeah, I think China, both from the liberal perspective and also from the more conservative perspective, is a really easy straw man to set up. So, for example, Tom Friedman writes about China as a great educational model because he wants to force the Americans to begin to, you know, reform our educational system in the United States. Whereas people from the right who want to create an enemy or to justify large increases in Pentagon funding, China is a very easy, you know, sort of bogeyman to say, so look, they're rising, they want to take over Taiwan, they want to have a huge submarine force, therefore we need to pour massive amounts of money into hardening Guam or to buy the latest of F-22 Air Force fighter bomber.
Right. Another thing you say is that, I'm going to read another quote. You say, the place remains an authoritarian state run by a party that limits the free flow of information, stifles ingenuity, and doesn't understand how to self-correct. Blockbusters don't grow out of the barrel of a gun, neither do superpowers in the age of globalization. So they've been able to carve this amazing economic growth with a few entrepreneurs harnessing this huge labor pool. But when you really need entrepreneurial creativity, their political system, you say, runs against it. What do you see happening in that regard?
Well, I mean, I'm not one of these people who is predicting China's collapse. All I'm trying to argue is that we need to leaven our enthusiasm about China's indeed very remarkable rise with a dose of reality, which is that they still have an authoritarian state that keeps a damper on the free flow of information, and you cannot become a global leader in this world if you do not allow information to flow freely throughout your society. That whole section of the piece was basically a riff off the Hollywood's latest blockbuster in China, Kung Fu Panda.
Right.
And the Chinese, the Kung Fu Panda has, and of course, it's a Hollywood product, but Kung Fu Panda has sparked this really interesting debate in China among sort of China's glitterati, in which they're saying, why can't we do this? This should have been our movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they've come to the conclusion that one of the reasons they can't do it is, well, first, they don't really have the irreverence that we have in America. But second, a panda is considered sort of a China's national symbol, and the Chinese government, the party state, might not even allow a China's national symbol to be made fun of like the Americans made fun of it, even though Kung Fu Panda has done very well in China. The Chinese haven't censored it at all. But in a way, it sort of just shows you the, in some senses, dearth of creativity in that type of field in China.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of gives you the sense that, okay, look, and the Chinese have this sense of, my goodness, you know, what we really need to do is set the agenda when it comes to Chinese culture. But even those kind of Chinese cultural items are being appropriated by Hollywood and used to make great money because the Chinese just can't do it. And that's basically my point. You know,
yeah.
Blockbusters don't grow out of the barrel of the gun. And like I said, neither do superpowers in this current age we're in now.
Right. One of the things that I found interesting was you write about that all of your classmates, their whole generation, went through the Cultural Revolution and Tiananmen Square, and they're now living through the economic boom. It's interesting what you say about the Cultural Revolution and its aftermath and how it shapes the people in current China and the kind of the culture in current China. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think with the way China studied in America, it's kind of sliced and diced. So we have sort of the 50s, then we have the Cultural Revolution, and then we have now. And there doesn't really seem to be a continuous narrative, but the people who are running China now, which is the generation of my classmates, the folks in their mid-40s, late 40s and early 50s, went through the Cultural Revolution. And, in fact, they were steeled in many cases formed by that experience. It was a formative experience of them. And what happened during the Cultural Revolution? Well, basically, Mao pitted fathers against sons, daughters against mothers, brothers against sisters. It was this horrendous dog-eat-dog type of system where everyone was afraid that even their closest friend, their closest relative could rat them out. And those type of values have been imbued in my classmates and in that whole generation, which is now at the top of China's food chain. And that has had an enormous effect on Chinese values and how Chinese society is organized today. And when capitalism, if you will, rolled into China in 1978 with Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms, which have only accelerated, you know, since the 90s, specifically after the Tiananmen Square crackdown, you had the combination of this capitalism, which is a dog-eat-dog system, with this sort of post-Cultural Revolution dog-eat-dog mindset to create a very, very social Darwinistic society, if you will. And that's the type of values that are running China today. And it's, you know, it's a very rough and tumble place to live in. You know, and definitely the weak do not inherit the earth in China. And it's a rough society. I mean, anyone who's ever taken a plane in China or driven a car in China knows that it's either eat or be eaten in that country.
Hmm. So in other words, here we have the great inequities that we've seen. We have what you know, in terms of financial inequity, we have what I believe are a shrinking middle class that has difficulty. But we can resort to a sort of a religious or cultural sense that that at least is a tension here between rugged individualism and a community.
Right.
And you're saying that they're basically China was originally a very this is something that I think is worth noting too, is as old time culture is very individualistic. Communism had its day, but what we have now is again like extreme individualism.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, in the West we have this conception, and I would argue it's a misconception, about China as being a really communal society. And if you use the word communal, especially in California, it's all considered, you know, very to the good. But, I mean, the China that I experienced is a China really of very, very strong individuals, very difficult to get people to work together in teams, something that I saw as a manager in China. And everyone wants to be the boss. And that has an enormously powerful economic aspect because they're such good businessmen. But on the other hand, it's also created a very atomized society. Now, the earthquake earlier this year was a moment for China to really band together, and you saw some really interesting new strains, specifically among young college-educated Chinese lining up to give blood, going out and volunteering in the earthquake zone. And that gave a lot of Chinese some cause to hope that perhaps we're seeing a tipping point and that the dog-eat-dog, or as in Chinese, actually, it's not dog-eat-dog, it's called man-eat-man, that type of society, was lessening, and we're seeing a transition to something else. That's possible. But the reality is that the party state has so limited the power of China's NGOs and China's charities that even if people want to give and want to sort of come together, if you will, the party state has been made it very difficult for them to do that in organizations that are not directly controlled by the party and the state.
Interesting that here we have Katrina, which indicates how frayed our community has become.
Right.
And there they have the earthquake, which shows the stirrings that perhaps they do have community. It's very interesting that when the crisis is bigger, it sort of, you know, shows what's really going on.
Right. Yeah, I think those two experiences in our country and in their country are something that would be a fascinating thing to sort of compare and contrast.
Mm-hmm. I see the time rushing away, but I have to ask you just a bit about Tiananmen Square.
Sure.
You were there as an AP reporter. You actually were very close to the scene. You were kicked out for it afterwards. If you could just briefly sort of it's not that often we get to speak to someone who was present there.
Reporting that experience, which it's basically started in April of 89 with the death of Hu Yaobang, I mean, one loses one's objectivity. You're seeing at certain points in May of 89, I witnessed, you know, more than a million, probably close to 2 million people on the street, marching for some type of unclear but nonetheless positive change for their country. It's an experience that I'll never forget. I mean, I've never been in a crowd that big, and felt such a positive sense of sort of a joyful move toward the creation of a better society. That all ended, obviously, on the night of June 3rd, the early morning hours of June 4th. I was in the western part of the city, where some of the first gunfire was unleashed on Chinese crowds. I'd never seen gunfire in anger before, didn't know what it was until people around me were hit, and then spent the next 7-8 hours watching the military move from west to east, invading effectively the city, killing hundreds. And then I found myself, I biked into the middle of the square in the early morning hours of June 4th. I said to myself when I got there, God, I've made it. And then I said to myself, you idiot, what have you done?
Yeah.
I was filing bulletins to the AP Bureau in Beijing via a cell phone that was literally as big as a loaf of bread. Didn't have the minis then. But luckily the batteries were good, and I filed up until 4:30 in the morning, and then I left the square with the last remaining students who were given free passage by the military out of the square. You know, it was a really tragic evening that I was in one way blessed, in some ways damned to have witnessed. But it's something that will stay with me for the rest of my life. Now, the Chinese will argue that, well, we had to do this because to do anything else would have unleashed chaos in our society. But the reality is, if you sort of look at it, the main trigger for chaos in China was not the people. It was the internecine struggles within the heart of the Communist Party that allowed the demonstrations that started with several hundred people in April to increase and to metastasize into millions of people in May that really triggered the Tiananmen Square crackdown. And so for the Chinese government and their sort of party apparatchiks to blame the people who are marching in the streets for the chaos and not to really sort of take the blame on themselves, I think is a little rich.
Right.
And I think it's important for us to realize that the real cause of instability in China has never really been the Chinese people, but it's always been their leadership.
Mm-hmm. And fights within the leadership.
Excuse me.
And fights within the leadership.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Leadership struggles.
Before I let you go, let's speak briefly about Chinese lessons. If you could say the five classmates you chose and then maybe, you know, just a touch about Zhu and Ye.
Right. Well, I wanted to write a book about Chinese people and about how they've coped with being Chinese, with being in a country that has literally flipped and flopped and flipped and flopped again, and how people survive and prosper, because many of my classmates have prospered and prospered quite well in a society such as that. And so I picked a fellow from a very, very poor region in the countryside who has become a very rich businessman. His business involves hawking products associated with urine, and there are such products, and he does quite well. I picked a party chief who was one of my roommates who basically tried to ignore me during our period of living together because he didn't want his file to be sullied with having had a close relationship with a foreigner, especially an American. I picked a woman who did something fascinating. She rejected her job assignment. In 1982, everyone who graduated from university was assigned a job. She rejected her job assignment in Beijing, which was considered a plum post, in order to get married. She did it for love, and I found her story and her love story to be really a compelling one. And then I profiled a dissident as well. A fellow who was not allowed to return to China after he got political asylum in Italy. But then, like so many of my classmates, he remade himself again, and he's now become a premier sports writer based in Rome. As you probably know, the Chinese are nuts
right,
about Italian
right,
soccer.
Right.
So that's,
wow.
That's the group.
Okay. And just I'll give you a minute and a half. So the one that seems most puzzling, or at least to us, is the one who is the party, big bluffer Ye.
Right.
So talk just a bit about him.
Well, one of the reasons why I spent a lot of time on him is because I don't think Americans understand. The literature in the United States about China generally is dominated by the stories of dissidents,
mm-hmm.
sort of sad sacks fighting against the machine. And I wanted to write about someone who has worked in the machine and been successful in the machine and who has prospered within the party state machine. And I wanted to give people a sense of the fire and the power and the desire of China's party apparatchiks to change their country and to build a stronger China and to make a lot of money on the side as well. And so I focused my attention on Big Bluffer Ye. Now, Big Bluffer Ye was involved with literally transforming a four-block stretch of Nanjing. And you could say, well, that's not really big shakes, but it's for me, it's a fascinating case study of how Chinese in the party have used their power to make and to really remake their country. And they've done this all over their country. I mean, you look at Pudong, which is a neighborhood in Shanghai that used to be rice paddies, and now it's got a skyline that's like right out of the Jetsons. And I wanted to write about the men and women who made those skylines. And so because of my roommate connection, Big Bluffer Ye allowed me access into his story.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, yeah, is that we not just dissidents, the other people we hear about are the entrepreneurs. But what you're saying is that in a country that is dominated by a political system like that, there none of that would be possible without the players within the party as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in China's not a country of like old Brezhnev or Andropov type guys staring at the wall. I mean, the party is run by very, very savvy people. If it wasn't, they would not be around.
Exactly. Exactly. So again, the website is johnpomfret.net. That's John. And then Pomfret, P-O-M-F-R-E-T, johnpomfret.net. The book is Chinese Lessons. Thank you, John Pomfret.